I'm Maria Carter, and today on Central Standard, the Olympics have arrived, and with it, tales of glory and honor that will be shared for many years to come. What kind of commitment and sacrifice does it take to compete at the Olympic level? Is it easy to return to a normal life once the competition ends? How does the cold weather impact an athlete's body? And for those looking to get into the Olympic spirit, what are the ways you can get a taste of the Winter Games in and around Kansas City? We'll be exploring the Winter Games today on Central Standard, which is coming up right after the news. The 2014 Winter Olympics kicked off a week ago in Sochi, Russia. Thousands of athletes are competing in events ranging from cross-country skiing to figure skating to snowboarding. We're taking an in-depth look at the games, from reactions from the Russian community in Kansas City to what it's like to train for this high level of competition. This is Central Standard. I'm Maria Carter. And today we discuss what it takes to become an Olympian and the particular challenges facing Olympians and other athletes in the winter. Also, we'll find out whether you dream of twirling on the ice or racing down the slopes on this week's Tell KCUR. And later we'll talk to a professor of Russian foreign policy about how local Russians are viewing the Olympics. Joining us now is runner Amy Mortimer, who is pretty darn close to going to the 2008 Summer Olympic Games. Amy, welcome.
Hi.
And what was your event, and just how close were you to the Olympics?
My event was the 1500 meters, and I was fifth place at the trials, and top three get to go.
And fifth place at the trials, top three get to go. How close seconds-wise were you?
I think I was about 3 seconds off.
Yeah. And I mean, to me, when you put it in those terms, it's like, that just feels like you were right there almost.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. Well, how does it feel being so close, but you know, yet so far from going to the Olympics?
It was pretty frustrating. I had been training since I started running when I was 12. That was my big goal, and I felt like that was my good chance to get to the Olympics. So it was a pretty big letdown.
Well, and how did you start running to begin with?
Well, my dad was a physical therapist, and he had kind of noticed I had a good running stride because I was terrible at all other sports. And so he started running with me a little bit. And then eventually he challenged me to a race, and I made him throw up. And after that, he started driving his truck next to me while I ran.
Well, it sounds like you had been winning races for a long time when you were younger. As you advanced through the ranks and maybe in college and then on up to that kind of national and, you know, world level, how did it change mentally when you go from probably being first or very, you know, a close second to being, you know, not quite there?
I think it's pretty hard for athletes to take. I know it was hard for me to go from high school to college. Like in high school, I would win most of my races, usually by a pretty comfortable margin. And then going to college, it was a bigger deal. And then once you got out of college, it was like every race was what would have been the national championships in college. So I think the pressure just consistently ratcheted up.
And how did that change the way you trained?
Coming out of college, I didn't have as much support. Like the college system, we had so much support. I had my coach there all the time, and we had training room staff, and so coming out of there, I kind of had to get some of those things on my own, and then I had to make travel reservations for myself and travel on my own rather than with the team. So that could be kind of stressful.
So it sounds like there's once you leave college, there's just a lot more responsibility and details that you as an athlete have to deal with.
Yeah, but you do have extra time since you're not in school all day.
and you were a professional runner. What exactly does that mean?
I was sponsored by three different shoe companies over the course of my career. And so we would get like a stipend, and then they also would give us a stipend for travel and also give us gear. And so, and then I would travel around most of the year, run races.
And did that help fund your training and, you know, competing in the, you know, national championships and such?
Yeah, that was basically the big goal of my life at the time. Like, I try to get enough money to keep doing the sport.
And was it enough to live on, or did you have to pick up a part-time job?
At times I had a part-time job. It was kind of hard to keep a part-time job because your training schedule took precedence over everything else. And so my mom was always really good at teaching me to live on a shoestring. So that helped me out a lot.
Well, take us through back then what your training schedule was like.
I'd usually get up in the morning and eat some breakfast, have a little coffee. My mornings were pretty nice. Could kind of just leisurely get around. And then like about 9 or 10, go for a run. Or if we had a workout, it might be later in the day. Or, I mean, a hard workout. And then come back, eat lunch, take a nap. And then either run again or lift weights. And then come back and eat dinner.
So did you have a coach, or were you on a team that trained together?
I had several different coaches. And then at one point I was living in Providence, and I had a team, or it was kind of like a group of girls that trained together. We were all from different countries.
And was that support from the other runners, was that important?
I think it really helps when you have other people that understand what you're going through, because I think sometimes from the outside looking in, your life can look pretty easy. I mean, there are lots of naps, and sometimes I kind of miss it now. But
speaking of that, what don't people understand about being a professional athlete?
I think the hardest part for me would be, like, my friends would get time off for Christmas, and on Christmas Day, I might have to go do a tempo run as soon as we got done opening gifts. So sometimes that would get kind of frustrating. Like, you just literally never have any time off, even though you have a lot of downtime during your day. And then I think the financial pressures, and then also just the constant performance pressure, can be a little stressful.
Yeah. Well, when you decided to stop pursuing running professionally, what made that decision for you?
Oh, my hamstrings and my age.
How old were you?
I was 31 when I retired.
Okay. And was it just the kind of the grueling pounding on the, you know, the track, the pavement every day that kind of wears the body down?
I think so. I just started tearing my hamstrings quite frequently, and I had always been pretty injury free most of my career. And so when it happened right before nationals a couple times, it was just pretty frustrating. And then financially, it wasn't really working out for me anymore. And just kind of ready to move on. I got married and was ready to start a family and have some a little more stability in my life.
Well, what was it like transitioning to a more normal lifestyle then?
At first, it was really brutal. I was so depressed that I mean, this was my goal for 18 years of my life, and I had been running professionally for almost 10. And so, I mean, I was crying a lot. It was really hard for a couple of months. And then I got a new job that I really liked, and I had a baby, and I don't know, slowly I just kind of started to be like, oh, I can have fun again. Not that I am able to stay up late anymore because of the baby, but I can stay up late if I want to and not have to worry about how it's going to affect my training the next day. I get just kind of, I don't know, it was just kind of relaxing.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sure you must run into people who are younger, some teenagers who look up to you and think, wow, I want to be that, or I want to go to the Olympics. Do you have advice for them?
I guess what I usually tell them is something I wish I had taken, or some advice that I wish I had taken from older people when I was younger. But I feel like I was so hard on myself all the time, and sometimes I wish I had enjoyed the ride a little more, get to go to all these great places. You get to, in college, like, my teammates were my best friends, and No, it was just like a wonderful experience. I wish I hadn't stressed out quite so much during it.
So, and when you say enjoy the ride, you mean, you know, not, do you mean not focusing on running so much and, or what exactly?
I think not beating yourself up when you have a bad race. I mean, I think you can be focused on running, but kind of dial back the self-abuse, I guess, when things don't go well.
Well, and Amy, in your life now, do you still do any running?
I have only been running a little bit because I'm studying for a test for my certification for my job, and then I have a 9-month-old, so he kind of takes up a lot of time. But when I do go out, it's really nice. I can just kind of enjoy it and relax. It's not,
And
I
we're
don't have a
talking of,
stopwatch
oh, sorry. We're talking
on.
about the Winter Olympics a lot today. Are there any Winter Olympic sports you think that you would have liked to have tried?
It seems like a lot of them involve risk of falling down a lot. I'm not very coordinated, so I'm trying to think.
I know a lot of runners do bobsled or convert into that.
Yeah, that does look like fun. I don't know if I have the raw speed for that, but I think, yeah, that's probably what I would go for. I really have to hand it to those guys. I can't handle the cold very well, and they do a lot of dangerous stuff.
Well, that's going to take us into our next topic. Amy, thank you so much for joining us today,
Oh,
and
thank you.
you know, have fun taking some time off and enjoying just a regular workaday life with your family and baby.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, and well, now we're going to turn our attention to what it takes physically to compete in below freezing temperatures at the Winter Games and. Or here in Kansas City. Do you exercise outside during the winter? And how does it affect your training? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And we're joined now by Nicole Moody. She's a professor of exercise and sports science at Rockhurst University. Good morning, Nicole.
Good morning.
And Nicole, do you participate in any winter sports?
I do not participate in the standard winter sports that you see in the Olympic Games. And I think that probably resonates with a lot of people in this area that maybe we've ice skated or skied at some point in our lives, but it's not something that we have the chance to do every day. Although I guess we could have taken up cross-country skiing or something like that over the last couple of weeks.
Well, you know, we were just talking to Amy Mortimer, and it sounds like she had a lot of natural talent. And I'm always amazed at all the different things that Olympians and professional athletes can do. How much of that is natural? How much of that is training?
A lot of it is natural talent, and I think that Amy really hit it on the head when she mentioned that she wasn't as successful at other sports, and then her dad recognized something different about her stride, something more natural. And that's just it. A lot of the times, athletes that succeed or are able to reach that next level of being a professional athlete, they have some different characteristics physiologically, biomechanically, and how they move that make them successful at that next level.
Is that something that you can identify ahead of time, like with a young child?
There are a lot of things that you can identify, whether you're willing to just have them participate in a variety of different sports. We don't really see as much of that now, but have them participate in a variety of different sports and see what they gravitate towards. But there are also specific tests, whether you test for speed or strength, power. Endurance, like Amy obviously had, there are tests that can be done for those.
Yeah, and how important is starting young for a lot of these sports? Like you always hear these figure skaters sometimes started skating when they were 2 or 3. You know, I mean, is it important to get that muscle memory maybe working when you're young?
It is very important. And as Amy mentioned, you know, she said she started distance running when she was 12. And I was a distance runner, and I don't want to, you know, downplay distance running, but there's not as much technique, obviously, involved in running. And if you think about the different moves that these athletes have to learn and perfect in regard to skating or maybe some of the skiing or snowboarding activities, on top of the fact that even though they're born with some specific attributes that might make them successful or lead to future success in those sports, at the same time, they still need to train the body to be able to withhold those demands and be able to do those activities for long periods of time.
Yeah, I'm guessing, you know, most of us spend a lot of time on our feet, even as little kids, mm-hmm. not so much time on skates or skis.
Exactly. It's something that is definitely provides an added realm of expertise that is necessary for those types of sports.
Well, you know, what is happening in an athlete's body, you know, when they're maybe starting to go down that ski hill or, you know, getting in position to do their figure skating routine?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's very similar to when any of us have some big event that we're anticipating, whether that is going out and actually performing on a court or a field or a slope. Or if you were to be driving down the street and you have to slam on your brakes all of a sudden to avoid a car wreck, your heart rate starts to accelerate. We hear about this adrenaline rush or that release of hormones related to the stress response. And those things start to take hold even before the athlete heads down the slope or starts that figure skating performance. And so they have to be able to control that so that they can stay calm and perform at their best.
And is that why you see, like, I'm thinking of figure skaters where they go out there and maybe they've done that jump 100 times in practice perfectly. They get to the Olympics, high pressure, they don't land it.
Right. And I think that these athletes, as Amy mentioned, they've dedicated their lives to this. They've made sacrifices that a lot of us can't even imagine. And so a lot is riding on these competitions, and they have to be able to psychologically be prepared for that.
Yeah, and a lot of times the Olympic commentators say, you know, they need to relax or get loose, or, you know, that an athlete's too tight or that's impacting their performance. You know, are there techniques that an athlete can do to, you know, relax before they do their race or performance?
Definitely. Many athletes perform just standard breathing techniques to help them relax, slow that heart rate, or get to that point, that zone of optimal performance. We've heard about getting into the zone for different sporting events, and that is very true. There's a lot of science behind it. Something that I know a lot of athletes practice is mental imagery or picturing techniques, where they actually picture the competition and how they want it to go and try to feel their body going through that perfect routine or that perfect performance, and that helps them get into that optimal zone.
Kansas City, what do you do to keep fit in the winter? What's the biggest competition you've ever competed in, and how did you prepare? Join the conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888, or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. You know, we're talking a little bit about exercising in the cold. It's been pretty cold here in Kansas City lately, so I'm imagining there are a lot of people who are thinking about the outdoors and how they wish they could be there. How should an athlete or anyone prepare to go outside and, you know, get their heart beat up?
I think that what is important to remember is that even though it's cold, even though it's snowy, it's not always it's not necessarily bad to exercise in the cold weather, as long as you are dressed appropriately, with enough layers on, and you warm up properly. So your body's going to take a little bit longer to warm up. So if you're doing high-intensity exercise outside, maybe double the length of your warm-up a little bit to make sure that the muscles are ready to withstand that intense exercise in the cold. But your body is designed to warm that cool air as you take it in. And so unless you have respiratory problems, asthma, or you're prone to bronchitis, there's really not a problem with exercising in the cold weather. What people need to worry about is making sure that they are keeping themselves dry. So whether that is making sure that they can protect themselves from snow or ice or whatever wetness might come into play when they're participating in their activity. But then also keep in mind that when we exercise in the cold, we still sweat. And so if we have that sweat staying close to our skin, that's going to make our bodies lose loses the body heat a lot faster. So if we wear clothing that allows that sweat to be wicked away, you know, a lot of times we think that this gear is marketed so well so that people will buy it, but there's a lot of science behind it, this cold weather gear as well. So if you wear appropriate clothing and take proper precautions, exercising in this cold weather is fine. Now, definitely take into account wind chill and those factors too, and everyone has a different comfort level. But personally, when we are in the negative temperatures, I don't go out in single digit temperatures, but other than that, I'll bundle up and bear the cold, assuming that the snow is not taking over the roadways and the sidewalks and things like that.
Well, I was going to say, is it more of a concern about slipping and falling when it's icy or snowy out than actually the physical exertion?
Definitely. And there are some devices or things that you can wear that will help with that. But definitely taking into account the roadways and the conditions are going to be very important.
Now, does it take more energy when you're exercising in the cold because you got to keep that body temperature up?
Well, because you have to keep the body temperature up, as you mentioned, it might take you a little bit longer to feel comfortable in your exercise routine. So I know for me, if I'm going out for a run, it takes a little bit longer to reach that point where I feel like I'm not breathing as hard. My heart rate is kind of steadied out a little bit. And one of the reasons for that is you're using different energy sources at the start of that exercise. Your body sees the exercise as more of a demand than it might be in a moderate climate. And so you might use a little bit more carbohydrates to help you produce energy. So if you can take in carbohydrates in your regular diet, keep in mind that warm-up that I mentioned, that's going to help you to get to that comfortable pace or that comfortable zone when you're working out.
And we have a caller, Elise from Pleasant Hill. Good morning.
Oh, good morning.
And what's your question or comment for us?
I guess I have like a comment and a question. I guess my comment was you guys were talking about stress hormones going before you're in a race, and I used to do cross country and wrestling. And before my races, I used to like kind of play head games with myself and tell myself like, okay, I don't care if I win or lose. I just need to get this race over with, because when I was worried about placing, I'd be way stressed out. So when I kind of talked myself down, I ended up getting a lot better times when I just kind of quit caring about winning for a few minutes. So, and I guess like my, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask if you prepared differently for cross country and wrestling.
I kind of talked myself down. I guess for wrestling, I used to listen to a lot of music before I'd go out there, because I even went to Nationals in Fargo when I was in high school for women's wrestling, and just having all those people around, I just stuck in headphones and kind of pretended it wasn't there, because it is really, it makes you really nervous when everybody's watching you. So.
And Elise, did you have a question for us?
Yeah, I guess with running, it's not fun to do in the wintertime. Like, my biggest problem is, like, even with, like, ear protection, like, my ears hurt really bad. Like, my ears will ache when I run, so it makes me not want to exercise outside. So I was wondering if you guys had advice for that one.
Nicole, any ideas?
I think the easiest advice, if possible, if you are not likely to run in the winter months because it's cold, if you can find an indoor place to run, a treadmill, which personally, I don't find all that fun. Have you ever tried layers on your head? So maybe like the ear wrap around your head or the headband, and then as well as a hat?
Oh, I haven't tried that.
Or maybe changing the material of your headband. So maybe think about, instead of like more of a cottony type material, something that has the potential to maybe wick the moisture away so that it can try and keep your ears and your head dry as well. That might help.
Okay, and do the headbands, like, will they say on the packaging, like, if they wick away the sweat and stuff, or?
Yes, they will. Okay. And you'll look for the materials that have more synthetic fibers as opposed to, like, the natural cottons.
Oh, okay. All right, thank you.
Well, thank you so much for your call, Elise. Nicole, you were mentioning earlier about still sweating while exercising in the winter. And how important is staying hydrated even when it's cold out?
It is definitely hydrated, and I think it's hard for a lot of us. You know, the best way to stay hydrated is to drink a lot of fluids, especially waters, things that don't have diuretics. And in these winter months, we gravitate towards warmer fluids. But if you can make sure that you're still taking in the normal amounts of water that you are, because I think if a lot of people kind of watch their drinking habits, they'll see that they do decline this time of year.
And how much water should that be if they're, you know, exercising?
For an individual that is exercising, you know, it's actually a misnomer that the eight-ounce glasses of a day is enough. In reality, a male generally needs about 3.5 liters of water a day, a female about 2.5 liters of water, and even a little bit more than that if you exercise a lot or you're a heavy sweater.
And should people worry about getting sick when they exercise out in the cold?
You know, as I mentioned, I think some people might be more prone to bronchitis or maybe kind of a nagging cough. And if that's you, if you exercise in the cold, I would recommend maybe wearing a scarf or some type of protection over your mouth so that you can still exercise in the cold, but just an added layer to help warm that air before you breathe it in. So I think that now I'm talking about maybe temperatures, wind chills into the teens, but nothing below that. So I think for the most part, healthy individuals should be fine.
And well, how much of we heard Elise talking about how she mentally prepared. You see a lot of the athletes listening to their iPods ahead of time. How important is music to kind of getting people in their the proper mindset, I guess?
I think it depends on the person. Everyone has their own rituals. She also mentioned that she had, you know, things that she would tell herself immediately before an event. And whether you have motivational words for yourself or you have music, and of course, that type of music is even going to be specific to each individual, what helps you stay in that zone for performance. But I think the key is whatever works for you and trying not to deviate based off of conditions. You know, I know I was watching several of these competitions this week, and I can't imagine watching the competitors before you and seeing how they would perform. So some people that might motivate them, some people it might distract from their game plan. So I think that just sticking with what works for you is really ideal.
Well, and you listen to some of the athletes talk about their training, and it almost sounds obsessive how, you know, especially with maybe something like figure skating or some of the snowboarding where it's very technique-based, about how many times they might do a particular action. I mean, how much of it in becoming a really successful athlete like that is just that motivation and that mental ability to kind of stick with something that might be getting boring?
I think that is a large part of it. You know, people can be born with all of these abilities that might eventually create a successful athlete, but if they aren't motivated to be dedicated to that sport, to put the time that's necessary, to make the sacrifices that are necessary, they won't get as far as these athletes that we see competing. And I think it's important to remember that, just like Amy mentioned, you know, we're seeing these athletes that have performed on, obviously performed on several occasions at a high level, but at the same time, they really performed well at the trials or whatever event led them to their participation in the Olympic team. There are a lot of people that would love to be in their shoes that are still high-level competitors that are making continued sacrifice, still trying to break it to that next level.
And one thing that I'm always amazed by is how young some of the athletes at the Olympics are. I'm forgetting the name of the Russian figure skater who's 15 years old. But, I mean, it's amazing that she's so young and can perform all these, you know, different jumps and things that I am assuming take years and years to learn. Is it more of an advantage to be young and have that physical stamina or to have some of the practice?
Based on how I feel sometimes when I go for a run, I definitely think that I had an advantage 10 years or so ago. But I think that it is an advantage. But I think some of those individuals may not, they might have the physical prowess, but they may not be at the psychological level that they need to be yet. And some individuals are, but for some people, it's harder, I think, when you're younger to handle all the pressure that is on them.
Well, and Nicole, what Olympic sports are you watching this year?
I'm watching, I mean, pretty much all of them that I can. I even, you know, I teach down the road at Rockhurst, and I leave the TV on in our space with the Olympics going on throughout the day. I argue that it's related to our field, so it's educational. But I've really enjoyed the snowboarding events and the freestyle skiing. I think a lot of times people think about those activities and they see that aesthetically they're nice to watch, but sometimes we forget that they're judged, but they're judged on their technique. And in order to perform those events properly, they have to be very strong, very powerful individuals. And there's a lot of work outside of just being on the slope or in that half pipe that goes into performing at that level.
Well, Professor Nicole Moody, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And we're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll find out how you can participate in winter sports in Kansas City. Central Standard returns in just a moment. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Maria Carter, and today we're talking about the Winter Olympics. And here in the KCUR newsroom, we've been dreaming about what sports we'd like to try for a little while now. I myself play roller derby and have always wondered how my skating skills would translate on ice. So recently, I headed up to Lion Creek Community Center in the Northland to give it a try. I joined the Kansas City speed skating team for a practice and filed this report. My Olympic dreams usually start and end with the remote control. But one Saturday afternoon, I checked out the Kansas City speed skating team. Practice started with an off-skates workout, a little cardio to get the blood pumping.
Butt kickers. Everyone ready on butt kickers? Ready, go.
And then balance drills, which involve standing on one foot, sometimes with your eyes closed.
All right, everyone, what we're going to do is start with your left leg on its toe, and then balance on the right leg.
Before heading onto the ice, Coach Brian Simpson tells me what his team is working on with the competition just around the corner.
In the past couple of weeks, we've worked on really good technique. Today, I want to see them put it together on the track all the way around for several laps.
The dozen or so skaters range in age from adults on down to six-year-olds. They're clad in everything from skin tights, spandex suits, to jeans and a t-shirt. But they all have one thing in common.
You know what you have on your feet? It's sharp metal blades.
Once practice starts, the skaters form pace lines, whooshing around the ice. Speed skating, at least on ice, is relatively new in Kansas City. Simpson started the team about a year ago, but he, like many speed skaters, didn't start on ice.
I started on wheels, quads, and then in the 90s I switched over to inlines. And then once I moved to Iowa, I switched over to ice, and that was over 12 years ago. And then when I moved here, I started the ice program here.
The ice program started small, just four skaters, and is now up to a dozen or so. Brian Simpson says he likes that it's something his family can do together. Simpson's ninth grade son, Brandon, is on the team and has his eyes on the Olympic rings.
I am looking at the 2018, 2022, and 2026 Olympics.
So after watching an hour of practice, I'm pretty sure I have no idea what I'm doing. So I asked Brandon for a little advice.
You gotta get down, you gotta bend your knees pretty good. You don't bend your back, you don't go like this.
I squat down into my closest approximation of what's called the basic position, and under Brandon's instruction, push my skate straight out to the side and start my lap. And at far slower than Olympic pace,
woohoo!
I finish one lap.
I don't think I'm setting any speed records yet.
Brandon says he hasn't set any speed records either, but he has qualified in his age group to compete at nationals this year. That competition is being held outside of St. Louis. Brian Simpson says if his son or any athlete gets really serious about training for speed skating, they'd need to move to Salt Lake City or Milwaukee. But having fun and getting in a workout on the ice can be done right here in Kansas City. As for me, I'll probably stick to roller skates for now. And while you can speed skate in Kansas City, the area is not home to a ski jumping hill. There aren't even mountains around here, so Esther Honig had to improvise on how to get the feeling of careening down a steep white slope before flying into the air. She found something pretty close, even if it's more of a summertime thing.
It's a cool 10 degrees outside this morning, and I'm visiting a place that sees little activity in the middle of winter.
Well, I'm Lane Pitcher, and I'm the guy that gets to talk about lots of fun stuff here at Schlitterbahn Kansas City Water Park.
In May of this year, Kansas City will become home to the Verrückt, the world's tallest water slide. Its construction is complete, and for the moment, sits under a blanket of snow, towering over the surrounding flat landscape. While the park is withholding the official height until opening day, we can say for certain that the slide is approximately 17 stories tall. That's just 10 stories shorter than an Olympic standard normal ski jump hill. And from the ground, the slide actually resembles a ski jump hill. So Pitcher agrees to take me to the top.
We've got 264 steps to climb. It will probably involve a couple of breaks on the way up, and we'll head up now and see what view we can get from up top.
20 minutes and 264 steps later.
Almost there.
Okay.
Whew. It's a climb. It is. From up here, you've got a fairly good view. You can see off in the distance downtown Kansas City, off to the east of where we're at.
From the initial drop, riders on the Verrückt will hit an estimated speed of around 65 miles per hour, while ski jumpers usually hit around 50 to 60 miles per hour. But to see how well my analogy holds up, I spoke with an expert, seasoned ski jumper Alan Johnson, who worked as the head ski jumping coach for the U.S. ski team for 15 years. And he's ridden a few water slides as well.
I've been on a couple of pretty big ones in Utah, and they scared me to death. Way more than ski jumping ever did.
Johnson says that riding down the Verrückt might actually feel like riding down a ski jump.
From an exhilaration standpoint, I'd say I can't think of a whole lot that would be more similar.
Of course, no one will actually be careening off the water slide and launching themselves into the air like in ski jumping. Passengers will actually sit together in a raft, and water jets will push them up the final hill. So we have our first half of the experience. All we're missing now is the actual jump, which Johnson says really doesn't feel that much like skiing at all.
It'll feel like someone's picking you up by the back of the neck and lifting you up. It probably is a whole lot more like hang gliding than skiing. That would be the closest thing you could find to the actual jumping component.
So, for ski jumping in Kansas City, your best option is to spend the morning at the Schlitterbahn Water Park and the afternoon hang gliding, preferably during the summer. For KCUR, I'm Esther Honig.
And we have a guide to living out your Winter Olympic dreams in the Kansas City area. Just go to kcur.org/Olympic Dreams. And we are going to start our weekly community engagement segment, Tell KCUR, where we open the doors of the station to ask you to answer a question we think may be on people's minds. This week, if you could do an Olympic sport, what would it be? Here to tell us about the response is KCUR's community engagement reporter and producer, Laura Ziegler. Good morning, Laura.
Hi, I'm Maria.
And, well, what's the response been so far?
Well, we didn't get as much response to this question as we had to other questions that we've put out there. We're figuring maybe people are watching the Olympics or that they just didn't want to admit what their failed dreams were. Most of our response did come from Twitter. So maybe people were tweeting while they were watching a specific event. We had a number of people who talked about events that they were watching. Steve said, I would shoot for something like curling, but he says with less physical activity, maybe more brooms. Don't hear a lot of people wanting to do curling around Kansas City. Nate tweets, definitely biathlon, endurance racing plus marksmanship. Bingo. Kathleen says she's, quote, too old, unathletic, and chicken, but that slope styling looks like amazing fun. Or biathlon, she likes too. And I want to say to her, come on, Kathleen, you're only as old as you feel or as your body can sustain. And Ron also says he loves speed events, so he dreamed about the luge, not something you can do too easily in Kansas City. But most of all, he fantasizes about being a downhill skier, but he's afraid of falling.
And those were our tweets.
Come on, guys. Yep.
Okay. And, well, you got some feedback from the phone as well, right?
Yep, the old-fashioned telephone phone. We got several calls. Someone suggested that snowshoeing should become an Olympic event, and particularly she said she'd like to do that at night. And now we're going to hear from a caller who said she dreamt about being an Olympic athlete. It's not an Olympic sport at the moment, but a sport that probably a lot of Kansas Cityans have been doing the past couple of weeks.
When I was a kid, I used to have a radio flyer sled, and I would race that thing down the hill in our backyard and wax the radio flyer runners, and I was convinced that by the time I got to be an adult, there was going to be an Olympic sledding event, and so I was preparing to be an Olympic sledder.
Oh, well. Oh, well.
But I guess bobsled wasn't close enough for.
Hard to do. Hard to do when you're a kid.
Well, were there any other responses that we should know about?
No, that's about it.
Okay. Well, stay tuned through the next week as we bring you more stories of Olympic sports you might be able to do or at least try to do in the area. And Laura, before you go, what Olympic sport would you like to try?
Well, I always fantasized while I was growing up about ice dancing, and even as I watch it right now, I think it's so beautiful. But I have to say I've also been watching the half pipe that women have been doing, and I want to say that that is totally gnarly, crunchy, and rad.
I think I heard your children just cringe.
Well, that's where I'm going to be training. I'm on the half pipe.
Okay, well, thank you to KCUR's Laura Ziegler. Laura Ziegler, let me say your name. And I look forward to next week's Tell KCUR. And we're going to switch things up. We're joined now by Maria Omilyacheva. She's a political science professor at the University of Kansas and specializes in international politics and Russian foreign policy. She's also from Russia. Good morning, Maria.
Good morning.
Well, what brought you to the United States?
Well, I came to the United States on an exchange program, and I fell in love with political science, and I applied to a graduate school at Purdue University in Indiana, West Lafayette, Indiana, and I pursued master's and PhD in political science with specialization in international relations there.
And when you heard that the Winter Olympics would be in Sochi, what was your personal reaction?
It was like, what? Sochi? Well, you probably all heard that Sochi is located in subtropical climate zone. So for many Russians, Sochi is associated with resort area, you know, bright sun, it's really warm. Fruits, you know, Black Sea, swimming, vacation. And so when the announcement was made that Winter Olympic Games will be in Sochi, it was a big surprise.
It sounds like you might have thought it would be more of a spot for the Summer Olympics.
Probably, yeah, much more so than the Winter Olympics.
And have you been there?
Yes, before the breakup of the Soviet Union, I grew up in the northern part of the European part of Russia, and for the northerners, just to spend a month or a few weeks in a summer camp, children's summer camp on the Black Sea, that was just such a treat. So I did spend a few summers in Adler, where the Olympic Games are taking place. It's a few miles away from Sochi, and Sochi itself, Suhumi, and some other areas there on the Black Sea coast.
And I've seen some tweets and people noting that it's warmer in Sochi than it is in the Kansas City area. And it seems like a lot of people are surprised to find out that the area, Russia, has a warmer spot in it. Is this just one of the misconceptions Americans have about Russia?
I believe so. And there's a tendency to forget. I mean, everyone knows that Russia is still the largest state in terms of its territory, just the sheer size. And as far as I know, Russia has every climatic zone except for the equatorial one. And it has multiple time zones, you know, if you go from east to west. And, you know, it takes almost as much to fly from the most western part of Russia to the most eastern part of Russia as it takes to cross the Atlantic Ocean. So just to put it in perspective, so Russia is big, and to make any kind of generalizations, whether it's about weather or people, you've got to be, you know, using lots of caveats. So whatever I'm going to say today, I should preface it by saying that, you know, you know, there will be exceptions to anything, anything and everything that I'll be saying today.
Well, what's the Russian community in Kansas City and Lawrence like?
You know, I think we also have to differentiate between Russian speaking community and Russian community. Russian community may be the ones who immigrated to the United States either before or after the breakup of the Soviet Union, but they used to be or continue to be the citizens or residents of Russia, Russia proper. But there are also Russian speaking residents of Kansas and Missouri who came from other post-Soviet republics, you know, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, maybe even Georgia. So it's, I would say that the Russian-speaking community in Kansas City area is pretty diverse, both you know, ethnically, in terms of their citizenship and backgrounds, where they come from.
And has the reaction to the Olympics been diverse as well?
You know, based on what I've seen on the social media, most of the comments relate to the sports, to the events, the sporting events that are taking place at the Olympic Games. You know, there is a pride and admiration of the figure skaters' performance, you know, anticipation of the hockey team performance. So the commentary is usually about the sports themselves.
Now, in the United States, it's been pretty popular to highlight problems in Sochi, and whether it's the opening ceremonies or hotel rooms, you know, there's the Twitter tag Sochi problems. Is this something people in Russia are hearing about, too?
Yes and no. It really depends on who you talk to. Like I said, Russia is big, and the citizens of Russia who come from non-capital cities, capital cities Moscow and St. Petersburg, or major cities with easy access to the internet and social media. But, you know, the majority of Russians live in smaller towns and villages where they are getting news from either state-funded news channels, TV channels or radio stations, or those TV and radio stations that are supported in one way or another by the government. So they are exposed more to the news that are less, by far less critical of what's going on in Sochi, and kind of praising the government's job on the side, because it's incredible in a way what the Russian government has been able to build in a place where there was nothing, you know, the Olympic Village, the trampolines, everything, the railroad, they were built from scratch. So the people from the periphery here are many more positive news, and they're less exposed to the criticisms of Western media. Plus, language barrier plays a role here. Not many Russians speak English to be able to understand the Western press news.
Well, you bring up the amount of money spent. You know, I think these are the most expensive Olympic Games, and you know, some say that that's money that's been wasted on corruption. Is that the perception in Russia, or are they seeing this as a good thing for that area and their country?
Yes, Russians do share concern with, you know, wasteful use of money, that some of this money were embezzled or mismanaged or just spent unwisely. So Russians do share this concern with corruption. Are they surprised about it? Probably not. But there is a widespread understanding and disapproval of the way the construction has been handled. But on the other hand, the public opinion polls also show that slightly above 50% of Russians approve of the decision to host the Winter Olympic Games in Sochi. So there is some pride, you know, there is belief that it's something that is going to, if not the Olympic Games themselves, but the performance of Russian athletes at the Winter Olympic Games should raise Russia's image, prestige, reputation. So so there is also a degree of positive assessment of the Olympic Games as an event.
Well, what's your gut feeling on whether the Olympics are helping or hurting the world's perception of Russia?
I think it's yet to be seen. I think the legacy of these games is yet to be seen. I would say that the criticisms of the Olympic Games have been toned down, even in the Western media, and it is the sports themselves that are currently in the limelight. You know, the discussion is about, you know, the performance of athletes from various countries, scores, you know, how many medals each country, what are the rankings of the countries in terms of the total counts of medals. Yes, the legacy and the impact of these games on Russia's image is yet to be seen. We still have, I think it's a week and a half of games. Hopefully, no threats will actualize during this period of time, and infrastructure withstands any kind of pressures, and, you know, weather is good. So yeah, it's yet to be seen. If everything goes smoothly, it may actually improve Russia's image.
Well, and certainly at least people now know that there's a warm vacation spot in Russia.
Absolutely, absolutely. Although currently many Russians prefer to spend their vacation in Turkey or some other states overseas rather than in Sochi.
And one quick final question. What sports are you keeping an eye on this Winter Olympics?
Oh, just like most of the Russians, it's figure skating, of course, less so hockey, and even less so skiing. But these are the three sports that Russians traditionally watch.
Okay. Well, I want to thank our guest, Maria Omelyacheva. She is a political science professor at the University of Kansas. You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page of KCUR.org. Tune in to Central Standard tomorrow as we explore Native American history in the Kansas City area. And stay with us for a conversation on Up to Date with Kansas City Mayor Sly James. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Christy Garten. I'm Maria Carter, and you've been listening to Central Standard on KCUR.